Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO, Finstrat Management. Excited. With us today, we have Kevin Lancaster. Kevin is the founder and CEO of Channel Program. Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. Let's start with Channel Program. What problem is the company solving in the marketplace?
That's a great question. So today, let me start with the premise of Channel Program first. After I sold my last cybersecurity company, it was called ID Agent. I sold it to a company called Kaseya based out of Miami. I kind of took a pause and said, there's gotta be another big challenge out there. And the challenge that we stumbled upon was that, there's a big disconnect in this marketplace. In the marketplace being the channel. You hear about this concept of a global IT channel, resellers or VARs or managed services. And the big challenge is that this marketplace is ridiculously fragmented. It's filled with little kingdoms, fiefdoms, pockets of MSPs here and there and all over the place. And it's ridiculously hard for vendors to access the channel and scale if that's the sales or go-to-market motion that they have. And so, I was fortunate to be on a couple of different sides of the channel, built an IT services company and exited that, built a high-growth software company, exited that. So I had a unique perspective on the challenges on both sides, right? Finding these great technologies to bring in the service clients or run our business more effectively. And at the same time, they had a keen or healthy respect for how hard it is for a vendor to actually, find these pockets and scale and exit or just scale in general. So the premise was, could we build a two-sided marketplace that brings both sides of this fragmented market together and allows the users, so the MSPs of IT services companies, to find and evaluate these technologies more effectively or more rapidly? And at the same time, can we centralize some of the marketplace that allows these emerging great technologies that are coming out to access or get in front of this channel and in a more streamlined and cost-effective way? And so that's where we started as a platform. And it's been a heck of a journey in this one, but it's progressing quite well.
Well, that's fantastic. And how many years in are you?
I think officially 4 years in. Okay. Four-ish years. So yeah.
And over those course of the 4 years, so it sounds like your experience gave you a great perspective as to where the problem lies, but was it always clear from the get-go as to how to best solve it?
Absolutely not. it's funny. The previous couple of companies was very, very straight line. We knew the problem. And we knew, roughly how to solve the problem. With this, we knew the problem. We didn't know exactly how to solve the problem or if the early concepts or ideas were even, valid or needed. And so, yeah, we did, the typical, market research to figure out, get reaction, and see if this is something that the industry wanted. And the early indication was yes. What we look like today is far different than what our initial premise was when we founded the business. And so, it's interesting, that there's, right. You talk to a lot of, high growth organizations and, sometimes it's a straight line path and sometimes it's, the dreaded P word, pivot. Occurs. But I think it's, in our case, the pivots that we did make, were pretty smart ones, that's got it to this point, today.
And how, you know, so as the strategy evolved, how much of it was you just relying on reading the tea leaves per se versus, you know, engaging either side of the marketplace to help, you know, inform where you needed to go?
A little bit of reading the tea leaves, but I think one of the benefits of this industry, that the channel in general, is that once you get in and you understand kind of the structure and you build relationships, they're very vocal and very engaging and you know, often very eager to provide insight. So, you know, we listened a lot. We listened to the customer on both sides. We listened to what the vendors wanted, and we listened to what the IT services companies wanted. And we listened and we listened and we listened. And then we made some corrections, and then we listened again and made some more corrections. And that's proven to be, it's been proven to be the right strategy for us, right? You know, getting that feedback and constant feedback. You know, we've kind of taken a different approach to growth relative to even most software companies. You know, oftentimes it's, you know, product led and build a product, and you know, maybe you're getting some feedback, but it's features, benefits of a product. And really what we focused on, and this became pretty clear early on, is that first thing is build a community. Mm. Right. And it's often ridiculously hard to monetize a community, especially when it's a free platform.
Right.
Right. And you know, maybe some of the investors that might be listening, but they're often, you know, they probably, you know, would agree that it's often extremely hard to go from free to paid. But what we did is we leaned into the community concept, right? And added value. And we monetized the vendors as they were coming in, because it was one of these things, well, if you build it, they will come. If you have the users and you have the, you know, the eyeballs and the interests and the metrics, then, you know, the vendors will come. But we really, our KPIs and what we had focused on early on is growing engagement with a community, and then, you know, layering in products as it made sense. And so a little bit unconventional path, but I think, it's worked to our advantage at this point, where we have, you know, thousands and thousands of users in the platform, and you know, and it's highly leverageable at this point.
Well, congrats on the success and traction. And without revealing any trade secrets, what can you share any of the steps that you took to get the community to attract the initial community and get it to coalesce?
Yeah, look, you know, we're fortunate that we had you know, relatively let's say this in a I don't know. Right way to say this, we've built some pretty strong personas in the channel, you know, just based on success of the last couple of companies and just in reach and access into the market. So we knew we had a pretty built in, you know, large following of people that were interested in what we were doing. So that certainly helped early on, right? Certainly helped getting the first several thousand, you know, users into the platform. And so it was great that we had kind of a built-in following, and they knew that, you know, everything we had done in the past was really around adding value and giving back to the community. And so that was a, you know, we were fortunate we had that as an attribute early on. The second kind of really interesting, maybe call it even an inflection point, was that, you know, as the IT companies, the IT service providers, and these MSPs were coming into the platform to start finding these vendors and engaging, you know, realized that they needed a tool to be able to organize themselves. And this kind of goes back to the feedback. You know, as we started to see the users come into the platform, we asked them, well, what's missing, right? You know, it's great that you come here, you're finding, you know, these vendors, and we're doing, you know, some of these, you know, online events and doing a little matchmaking here and there. What's really missing? And remember, a couple of the MSPs, all probably within a week of each other, all said, it'd be great to have a tool to be able to visualize my technology stack. Mm. You know, and, you know, at the time I was like, all right, it's interesting, but it was almost like, I almost felt like it was kind of a throwaway idea, but I started sort of, you know, noodling on it. And I said, yeah, you know, right? Like, there's really no, no tool out there or platform that allows you to really visualize all of the different technologies that you're working with. And just, you know, taking an MSP, for example, managed service provider, you know, average MSP is working with 75 different technologies to either deliver their services to their customer or to run their business internally. And once we started to build out that first prototype of what we called Navistack, and we had the early adopters start to, you know, build these, build their stack and visualize it, we realized, hey, we're really onto something. We're solving a pain point, you know, and it's pretty static. It was basically come in and visualize it and see what your gaps are. But just doing that led to tens and tens and tens of thousands of product additions inside the platform. And so that was really, I think, the first really big inflection point in this, in, you know, kind of the evolution of channel program, is that, yeah, it's a very basic, solve a need, give them a visualization tool, facilitate the connection, you know, and then what can you, you know, layer in on that, you know, downstream, and make it even more valuable. And so that was I think, really interesting pivot point for us about, you know, I shouldn't say pivot, but interesting addition to the platform that we stumbled across or stumbled upon, you know, maybe 24, 25 months ago, something like that.
Well, I think if anyone ever needed an example of the value of, you know, engaging your clients or your customers, I mean, that's it. Because I'm sure if we were to unpack the amount of successful products in the market, I bet you, you know, they all have similar roots. You know, mm-hmm. You start off one way, you get feedback. You know, I know that happened with Slack. I know that happened with, you know, no shortage of products that, you know, I've read about over the years. So you're a serial entrepreneur. If we could take a step back, you know, I would love to get a sense of where things started, whether you always knew you're going to be a founder, and how things progressed with the IT services company and then ID agent.
In other words, when did I realize I was unemployable? I think I learned that one pretty early on. No, it was interesting. It's so my brother is 10 years older than me, and is very entrepreneurial. He kind of cut his teeth in a real estate, you know, marketplace, and I early on saw the hustle, learned the hustle, I guess, if you will, watching my brother. Yeah. So that was kind of my earliest memories of, you know, if I'm going to go out and do something, and, you know, I'm going to, I don't know if it was a narcissistic or what, I don't know what it was, but I'm going to bet on myself. And so, yeah, you know, I had a couple corporate gigs early on. By happenstance, I had an acquaintance, a friend, that said, hey, you know, I'm thinking about starting this consulting practice, this business in DC, and, you know, do you know how to put a business together? And maybe I can figure it out. So we launched down the path of starting a government contract consulting firm that expanded into an IT professional services firm and reseller. And that thing grew phenomenally well over, you know, I think I was involved with it for about 20 years, and served to be a platform that allowed us to build out to kind of that second business, which was called ID Agent, which was focused on cybersecurity and dark web monitoring, and spun that out and scaled that and was able to exit that business. But I think I realized early on that, you know, I didn't want to be kind of the typical 9-to-5er, and you know, maybe I felt like I had a chip on my shoulder or something to prove, or maybe it was really that I was unemployable, that I went down this path of starting businesses and haven't looked back.
Well, congrats again on the success. Key lessons you learned with the first two companies.
Oh man,
what not to do.
I remember two things vividly that were like game changing for me. I remember early on, and this is early 2000s. We just got our nice fancy website up and running, and I hired a company and they gave me a login. And I remember going in one evening and said, I'm going to put up a new page on this new crazy service that we're going to provide. I was all proud of myself. And then the next morning, our marketing director came in and said, hey, I see you put a website up, but you misspelled like four words, right? And I said, oh man, all right. Let me not do that again. Let me not get in the way of other people. Let me let the people that do, you know, their jobs exceptionally well. Let me let them do that. And let me not, you know, be the one that gets in the way. And the second was when hired our first controller, because I remember, you know, balancing the, you know, the account, the checkbook at the time, right? The ledger, you know, I'd be up till midnight, balancing that thing to a penny, watching every check come through. And it was addictive, but I realized that that wasn't productive. And so I think the second really kind of, you know, game-changing thing me for, you know, for me early on was bringing in, you know, somebody that was smarter than me in finance, somebody that could take the lift and manage this stuff day to day. So it kind of goes along those lines of like, you know, hire smarter, right? And get out of the way. And I think that's, if there's been any attribute or successful attribute or maybe common theme in the last couple of businesses, it's always been hire smarter, right? And I don't know, that was one of the lessons I learned early on. One, because, you know, maybe I'm not the best speller in the world, and two, I had to go out there and start selling, and I couldn't do the fun stuff like, you know, balancing the account like I wanted to do. I had to actually help be an extrovert, which was tough for me early on.
Yeah, you know, I having worked with a lot of founders, you know, I my sense is, you know, you hit this inflection point where there's the work piles up, and eventually you have this aha moment when you say, if this thing's going to succeed, I need to delegate.
Yeah, 100%.
I agree with you 100% that, you know, budget willing, the sooner you can do that, the better.
Yep.
You know, I think about stack ranking priorities, and I think I find that they always come back to sales and product. Mm-hmm. And so, okay. So ID agent, you mentioned you had a successful exit. You know, we obviously want all founders to follow suit. And so what was that process like, finding a potential acquirer, working through the due diligence process with them, and ultimately making sure that, you know, the founders and the acquirer were content that this was a win-win?
Yeah, it was a, you know, pretty intense process. You know, we were very, again, fortunate that with that last company, ID Agent, that it was the right market, right time. I mean, just all the stars aligned. Early on, you know, this is going back maybe the 8-9 years ago now, nobody understood, knew, or were talking about this thing called the dark web, right? Hmm. It was mysterious. No one knew about it. No one even knew what a Tor browser was or what have you. You know, we had with the consulting firm, we had just won a large contract with the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, mm-hmm. after they were compromised by a nation state. I think it's generally understood it was China that compromised the records of 4.2 million government employees and retirees. Yeah, that was a catalyst for us to, you know, think through this this capability that we had developed and, you know, commercialize this platform where it allow, you know, businesses to figure out if their data is out on Tor or the dark web, and if their passwords are out there or other PII. And, you know, we won early on as we kind of built out the prototype, we won some, you know, great government customers. And then we won some large enterprise customers, but we stumbled upon kind of really the channel. And so we simplified the platform because the use case was a little bit different for managed service providers, IT providers versus some of the large, you know, direct customers that we had. And when we simplified it and we, you know, figured out that the key to building any channel business is enabling your channel partners, that thing just took off. And it also didn't hurt that I think that year Experian had started advertising their dark web capabilities at the Super Bowl. So you know, that, you know, we quite often thank them for their $70 million marketing budget to help us get going, because it became, you know, part of the zeitgeist at a certain point. And so we just ended up scaling ridiculously, you know, well, really fast, to thousands of partners. And underneath of those thousands of partners, there were millions of businesses and users that we were monitoring and protecting. And so we were essentially the darling child of the channel. And so the process was a quick one, because we'd actually had started to pick our head up and said, all right, well, let's go out and raise a round and really accelerate this thing. And, you know, we had term sheets lined up. We had a bunch of organizations that were ready to go. But then a couple of the big players in the channel came to us and said, you know, absolutely not. You know, we're acquiring you whether you like it or not. And, you know, if we were fortunate to be able to say, well, it has to be, you know, it has to be a crazy number and it's got to be guaranteed. And, you know, it worked out that way. And so it was actually, you know, slightly unconventional, but it was a quick process, because again, we were, you know, we had the luck, the dumb luck of being the fastest growing, you know, security company in the channel. And so we could, you know, essentially, you know, name our own price at that point. Kind of odd saying that, but yeah, that's what happened. And it turned out to be a very successful acquisition. I stayed on for a couple of years. I helped them, Kaseya, who bought it, run their go-to-market. And so, you know, I'd had a really interesting insight in running a, you know, now valued at some, I think somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 billion, you know, organization, but having a pretty significant impact on our go-to-market strategy and acquisition strategy. So all in all, I mean, it was, you couldn't have asked for a better outcome and then a best post acquisition outcome, because, you know, obviously quite often those go,
yep,
they don't go as planned, right? There's always conflict, not always, but there's often conflict. And, but in our case, it couldn't have been executed any better. We just had a, you know, phenomenal, you know, outcome, and then a really good experience for the couple of years that we were there.
Oh, congrats.
Yeah.
So let's come back to channel program. So, you know, we touched on strategy, distribution, the product. You know, I always also think about people being integral to a company's success. You know, how do you think about hiring? How do you think about firing? And, you know, how deliberate are you with building culture?
Yeah, it's, man, that's a phenomenal question, because in a lot of ways, no matter what kind of product you have, you don't have the right team around you, then, you know, really, what's the point? So we're pretty intentional, pretty deliberate, and fortunate, whether it's the last, you know, couple of companies, but particularly with this company, that, you know, early on we had very well-defined roles and very competent team members in those roles. So Matt, one of the co-founders, you know, he loves being up on stage and he loves really adding value back to the industry. So, I mean, I can't even keep track of where he is most days of the week, because he's on stage somewhere across the land. And then on our enablement team, you know, again, it was very intentional hires, because we want the best of the best to enable these channel partners. And so yeah, it's not just skill set, but it's personality, right? Mm-hmm. It's commitment. It's, you know, it's their desire to really want to, you know, support the channel. And we're in a unique space, because the channel is very dependent on their vendors, right? And they're kind of lifeblood of the channel partners, these vendors. So we're very intentional about who we hire and how we hire. You know, on the culture side, I have to admit, it had been challenging over the last couple of years, as the world had been primarily remote. So we've had a massive initiative to get our team members centralized around our office down in Fort Lauderdale and the one here in Maryland, to really, you know, really, you know, enhance culture, because you can do it remotely and there's tools and it works, but nothing beats, you know, being in the same room and just walking down the hall on the whiteboard. Or, you know, I get a thrill when I'm down in Fort Lauderdale And in the sales bullpen, they've got the music on in the background and they're hitting the gong when they sign and they're high-fiving. I mean, it's just, you can't replace that.
Right.
And that's as much of culture as the individual personality, right? It's the team and the group dynamic that you just can't replace. And so, you know, I've been very intentional about it. And, you know, I think culture makes or breaks an organization, period, end of story.
And so when there isn't a good fit, you know, how you know, what's your preference? Do you find that you do a lot of nurturing, or, you know, are you more quick to say, hey, you're great, but, you know, you're just not the person for the role?
Yeah, I think that's another interesting question, in that there are times and there are roles where you should, you know, be patient and invest in nurture, right? But, you know, every business is a people business, and that is just, you know, it's what you should be doing. But there are also times when you realize it's not going to work, right? It's not going to work. And I see that far too often in the companies that I advise or invest in, that they let it fester and they let it fester and let it fester. And whether it's, you know, they're disruptive to the culture, or they're just individually, you know, less than competent in their role, you know, every day that goes by is you know, it's a missed opportunity across the board for the organization. So there's definitely a balance between, you know, investing and you know, letting go sooner rather than later. But also comes back to, you know, if you're not learning lessons when you're hiring, to avoid the hiring mistakes, and you know, you got to look inward as well. So it's definitely situational dependent, I think that's a trap that a lot of folks fall into. It's the comfort zone, and you know, the avoidance of conflict. Sometimes it's just a necessary evil, and it's not fun, and it's counterproductive, and it's obviously more expensive to, you know, have to go back out and hire. But sometimes you just have to rip the Band-Aid. You know, what's best, you know, it's best for the business. And so and it's just, you know, it's a tough one, but sometimes it has to be done.
Yeah. And I infer is an opportunity cost, you know, even, you know, if you give someone a shot, you know, arguably, you know, that could be someone else filling the seat who can be making forward progress during that time.
And look, I think that's going to be really interesting, really challenging here for the foreseeable future, you know, with the whole AI dynamic that has been thrust upon us, you know, over the last, you know, 18 months, but more specifically the last 3 months, where you're seeing the material benefit and impact of AI all across the organizations, optimizing, you know, different departments, organization developing, you know, 5-6 times faster. I mean, that's really going to throw an interesting dynamic into the overall hiring process. And then it's going to throw an interesting variable into kind of the structure of existing teams and what they might look like 12 months from now, 18 months from now. So it's, that's an interesting, you know, an added equation that we weren't thinking about 18 months ago, for sure.
Well, the irony of it is that literally was my next question.
My apologies.
No, it was good. So let's talk about artificial intelligence. You know, my question was going to be, where is it on the product roadmap? But I would love to talk about it, you know, broadly as well. I mean, if you can give us a sense of, you know, how you're thinking about incorporating it from a feature and function perspective, but also just from a back office operational perspective. I know this is a really big topic right now.
Yeah, like I think it's the entire product roadmap is AI at this point. We were probably like the typical organization 12 months ago, even maybe 6 months ago, where we're prompting on ChatGPT and some of these LLMs, and you know it's great, you see the incremental progress, but then, man, all of a sudden it was thrown in your face. And so whether it's, you know, using a Bolt or a Lovable on the front end to prototype, and then quickly pushing that into Cursor to, you know, spit out code. It is having a tremendous, tremendous impact on our ability to develop, prototype and develop and get product to market. It's incredible, right? And it's an interesting dynamic with, especially in the devs, in the dev world, because a lot of the devs are thinking, is this an existential threat to my my livelihood? And reality is it could and it will be in some scenarios, but we're fortunate the devs that we have in our team have embraced it and they've realized the power of some of these tools and how it's going to allow them to code, develop faster, and spend more time, you know, basically, you know, auditing before going on. It's having an absolute material impact. So that's kind of on the dev side, which is great, but all across the organization, right? And we have an initiative internally, and we started with sales and marketing because, you know, that was really kind of the first wave of AI, you know, agentic AI, you know, tools that were just something more than a prompt. So we've embraced it on in sales and marketing, and not just, again, writing, you know, emails, but everything that we do as far as analyzing the data in the platform and conversions and how to optimize. And then the next step for us is to really, how do we deploy that across all aspects of the business, even from upfront and hiring, you know, and automating kind of the interview process, the screening process. There's some, you know, phenomenal tools out there as well. So AI, it's like every day, you know, it takes, you know, 7 steps forward and you unlock these ridiculously amazing use cases. So it's having an operational impact internally, right? And it's in development and how we think about product and go to market and honestly, how fast we go to market, because, you know, these AI tools are going to make it that much easier for others to enter markets and scale as faster, if not faster. And then again, we're looking at it across every aspect of the business and how can we really lever this to make it a better experience for employees internally, and then just overall make, you know, larger incremental improvements in productivity across the business. So it's in 3 months, 4 months, it became all right, that's interesting, to, if you're not doing it now, you are late to the game, truly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as I'm listening, you know, I hear, you know, reallocating capital from product to sales, you know, and, you know, even if, you know, there are a lot of other companies are thinking the same way, it has the effect of increasing competition, mm-hmm. Which, you know, in a free market, I think about being a net benefit in the long run to everybody. But to your point, it's like, yeah, there's the speed component too. And, you know, I know there's a lot of conversations going on right now is, you know, will the benefits of AI fall to the early stage companies like Channel Program or the incumbents? And I don't think it's a black and white answer. I think it totally depends on the problem they're solving, the industry, the sector. But it's interesting hearing how your thought process is playing out. My personal opinion is you're on the right track by seeking to grab more market share by taking advantage of these efficiencies.
Yeah, you know, if I can just add something to that. So we put out this interesting report, do a couple of these reports every year. And the last one we just put out was IT management software report. And when we looked at these product categories up on our site, we looked at them 12 months ago. We looked and saw there's around 28 primary product categories. And that meant that, you know, you could associate at least half dozen vendors to each one of these product categories that were single product focused vendors, right? Fast forward to when we put this report out, but 2 months ago, we brought that down to 13 primary categories because as we looked at it, you know, some of the single product category companies, they got acquired or they, you know, built in things. But, you know, fundamentally what happened with a lot of those product categories is they became features of larger platforms, and they became features ridiculously fast because AI allowed, you know, these dev teams to build in, you know, secondary, thirdary, you know, tertiary capabilities into their platforms. And that made these, you know, individual product category is almost obsolete. So yeah, to your point, I think, you know, it's depending on the use case and the industry and what have you, but it's also relative to how fast the incumbents or the larger legacy businesses are adopting AI and building, you know, these, you know, emerging categories into their existing platforms. And it's also is, you know, on the other side of that spectrum is it's how fast these, you know, upstarts are thinking about new product categories and bringing them to market. And then, you know, so this is played out, that whole buy versus build scenario has played out, you know, over the last, you know, forever in this space, but that the dynamic has changed quite dramatically because it's, you know, it was pretty clear for most companies, even, you know, 12 months ago, what their answer was going to be, buy versus build. And right now it's not as clear because it might be even more effective and faster, you know, to market to build using some of these AI tools. So this will be a fascinating area to look at over the next 12 to 18 months. And you guys are right in the thick of it with all the organizations you. So you must have pretty interesting perspectives on this as well.
Yeah, you know, I tell you, my thesis at the moment is, you know, success will continue to lie with early stage companies being niche, because, you know, I've seen, you know, so if there's a profile for incumbents, you know, they're multi-billion-dollar organizations, you know, depending on what problem they're solving, you know, companies like that have floors on revenue as to where their interests lie. And so you and I both know that at the end of the day, cash is king. You can have the greatest feature function set on the planet, but if, you know, if no one's buying it, it's inconsequential. Yeah. And so, you know, my sense is solving very specific problems is the starting point. And then as you gain traction, you expand the net, or, you know, you figure out a way how you can expand the revenue within your existing client base. I think, you know, if there's a consequence, it's a question of whether or not, to your point, buy versus build, do we see a lot more acquisitions? I could see that happening given that, you know, the IPO market is only just starting to thaw. Yeah. And you have a lot of investor-backed companies where I imagine either intentionally or unintentionally, you know, there's a pressure to monetize.
Sure.
You know, I'd like to think at the end of the day, the founders will be done. But you could see the scenario where, you know, either consolidation, acquisition, you know, just starting to pick up.
Yeah.
Kevin, close to wrapping up. Before we do, you have a tremendous amount of experience, but if you were given the opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self and pass along any sage advice, what would it be?
You know, every entrepreneur starts this path and there's always, you know, there's always that feeling of imposter syndrome, right? I don't know if I could necessarily put my finger on it, but what I haven't been afraid to do, which is interesting, is I haven't been afraid to reinvent myself along the way. So I spent 16, 17 years eating, breathing, sleeping government acronyms, right? And being, you know, just immersed in GovCon and contracting and, you know, everything that comes with that industry. And that was my identity for the longest time. I mean, it was just, you know, I was, you know, just out, you know, in the burbs of DC, and that's what I did and what I knew. Along the way, I, you know, was fortunate that we had won several security oriented contracts and leaned into cybersecurity and that universe for, you know, 8-9 years and leaned into that persona and that industry and really became a subject matter expert in many areas. And, you know, if you look at me today, it's like I'm bringing these, you know, a couple of worlds together, and I feel like I almost have a third personality. There might be like a fourth and fifth in there somewhere as well. But yeah, you know, I think the hardest part for any entrepreneurs, you know, especially when you're in the throes of it, you know, or maybe even when you get a little success, is that imposter syndrome, right? And it's the confidence. And in some regards, it's fuel. In some regards, that can be extremely debilitating. But I think for me, it's kind of looking back, and I'm, I don't know, I'm kind of glad I went down this path. I wasn't afraid to, reinvent myself a couple different times. And so, I don't know if it's sage advice or what, but I think it starts with confidence. I always knew that I wasn't the smartest person in the room. I always knew that I could associate, at least tag along with the smartest person in the room and learn a little bit, just enough to be a little dangerous. And so I think that's been one of the things I think that's gotten me through the last, 25 years is listening and not being afraid to put yourself out there. So I don't know if that's sage advice or what, but it's gotten me to where I am, and I'm not looking back.
Well, I appreciate you being candid. Mm-hmm. I would tell you my own experience mirrors yours. I think hustling solves so many problems. I think there's an appreciation, having now talked to a lot of founders, where especially in the beginning, like, really, am I able to do this? And maybe you can, maybe you can't. There's only one way to find out. And I think having a mentality that, even if I make mistakes, I'm going to keep pressing. If there is a formula, that's part of it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Kevin, very successful career. Anyone you'd love to give a shout out to who's had a material positive impact on you along the way?
Well, I could tell you that none of this would have been possible if I didn't have, a wife that was equally as committed. I mean, she was an amazing trial attorney. She gave that up, and she helped raise the kids. I mean, very capable. And I always say, we would not be where we are if, we didn't divide and conquer the way we did. And so I had to absolutely give her a shout out, because there's no way, we could have gotten to where we are without her sacrifice. It's, without being too obvious, I think that's the, at least that's the obvious one for me, because I mean, she sacrificed a lot to help us all get here. So give her a big shout out for that.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, the significance of choosing partners, personal, professional, big deal. So that's awesome. Yeah. Kevin, appreciate your time. A whole host of great insights. Before we wrap up, if there are any members of our audience who'd like to learn more about Channel Program, how can they find them out?
It's just simple, channelprogram.com. Got solutions for the IT industry and now direct customers with our Better Tracker platform that helps manage subscriptions and expenses and contracts. And we've got solutions for vendors that help them manage their channel. So check us out at channelprogram.com.
Fantastic. And again, for the benefit of our audience, Kevin Lancaster, founder and CEO of Channel Program. Kevin, thank you again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
My pleasure. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com/podcast-guest. If you've got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.